Welcome to the Geological Society podcast. My name's Sarah Day, and today I'm joined by our Shell lecturer, Dr. Adrian Glover, who is a researcher at the Natural History Museum and has just been talking about hydrothermal deep sea vents. I was very surprised, and I think a lot of our audience probably were, to hear that hydrothermal vents were first discovered by geologists.
Yes, that's right. It is one of the most amazing stories in really all of biology, really, and certainly in oceanography and marine biology, that first cruise. And it's about how science works in a serendipitous way. You don't always know what you're going to find. And they really thought that they were going to find hydrothermal vents. They had a very good knowledge of that. But nobody had actually thought that maybe where there was hydrothermal venting on the seafloor, that there would be this remarkable diversity and abundance of life. And in particular, forms of life which were just totally unfamiliar, even to people studying deep sea biology already. We knew that the deep sea was diverse and there were plenty of animals there, but nothing like the forms of life that they found on those first cruises, which must have been tremendously exciting for them. This is the late 1970s. So, in fact, the first cruise to the Galapagos Rift was in 1976, and it was, again, a geological cruise. And they actually passed over one of the hydrothermal vent sites. I didn't mention this in my talk because, you know, there's a limited amount you can get into 45 minutes. But Peter Lonsdale, a scientist at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, he was involved, and actually they passed over one of the vent sites and noticed, using a very basic towed camera system, these clamshells sitting on the seabed. And alongside those clamshells, just a complete coincidence, there was a can of beer lying on the seabed, visible in one of the photographs, and it's published in Lonsdale 1977, the paper that was published. It was that can of beer which it made them interested, because they realised, oh, that's weird, those clams are rather big because we have a scale bar, which is a beer can. But it also made them suspect that what they were looking at was the discarded remains of some party that had gone on a boat, and they'd thrown over the remnants of the party, a clam bake party, where they cook up a whole load of clams and thrown it over the side of the ship, and now she's just looking at some rubbish on the seafloor, which is why the first hydrothermal vent site was called Clam Bake.
And perhaps you could just say something very briefly about what a hydrothermal vent is, because I don't know if it's a concept people are very familiar with, and how common are they?
That's right. During the talk, I sort of showed a couple of videos to illustrate what we call these sometimes we call black smokers, these most dramatic of hydrothermal vents, and that's where it's easiest to see what's going on. And effectively, it's quite simple. The seawater's percolating into the oceanic rocks, and it's getting increased in pressure, and it's getting subjected to high temperatures deep in the Earth's crust. And then in long fissures, it's forced out under quite high pressure and at very, very high temperature. And of course, when you're in the deep ocean, you can heat water up to much higher temperatures than 100 degrees C, where it boils at our atmospheric pressure. And at those very, very high temperatures, when it hits the cold water, the background cold water, which is between 1 and 3 degrees centigrade, usually most of the world's oceans, it precipitates out all these minerals, which makes this black smoke. And sometimes it's, depending on the chemistry of the hydrothermal vent, not always black. It can be white as well, or different colours, depending on what's being precipitated. And that's what you see. But alongside that, there's all of this diffuse flow of chemicals around the vent area. So you have these very dramatic smokers, these big chimneys, and you also have animals growing on the diffuse flow around the hydrothermal vent chimneys. So it's a very unusual, remarkable habitat.
And we saw some videos and some pictures of the amazing ecosystems that exist there. Why is it that they're such a hub of life?
The reason is that essentially they're these islands where there is a major amount of food available compared to the background around them. So when you're, for example, if you went down in a deep sea submersible or a remotely operated vehicle, as we've just been in March this year in the Cayman Trough in the Caribbean Ocean, you're essentially passing over rocky sediment-strewn areas of the deep sea, which, although I know that there is quite abundant life in those sediments, it's not dramatic. There's not big animals there. But as soon as you get to these vent fields, suddenly the energy available for life has increased by several orders of magnitude because of these sulfide emanating out of the hydrothermal vent chimneys.
So it's not the hot water. I think a lot of people think it's because there's cold water at the bottom of the sea and then they find areas of heat, but it's not actually that.
I dare say some of those animals, maybe they like to hang out in the hot water a little bit. It might help increase their metabolic rate a little bit as well. But the reality is that's not what they're feeding off. They're feeding off these chemicals which are coming out of that. And in fact, that's where the microbes come in. There was a question at the end of the talk, you know, it was asking about the microbes. And of course, that's not my speciality, but they are key It's the microbes which are able to use, in particular, the sulfur, sulfide, this reduced chemical which is coming out of the chimneys and actually fuel that ecosystem.
And you've actually been down to these areas yourself?
So I've been down in the sense that I've been in a ship with a remotely operated vehicle. And in the early days of exploration, people did use submersibles, and they still used a little bit, but there's only one or two in the world. And almost all of our research now is using what we call ROVs, remotely operated vehicles.
So you're sending things down with sensors and cameras and waste?
We have in the United Kingdom, we have the Natural Environment Research Council as a facility called ROV ISIS, which is an amazing facility able to dive to 6,000 metres, the size of a small car, and bristling with cameras and sensors and equipment for picking things up, little arm manipulator arms. It's a very immersive experience working with that facility. You're sitting in a little cabin on the ship. In fact, it's a container covered in screens, giving you live video from all angles from the vehicle. So it's essentially like being there. And it's revolutionised us. I mean, in many ways, I think I made the point at the beginning of the talk of how the first Alvin dives and all the sub dives, they didn't have any ability to even record video. You know, it was very much observation-based. The scientists would come back and they would tell you what they found.
Nowadays, so they would go down there physically themselves?
Absolutely. Those first dives in the 1970s were with manned submersibles.
You're not tempted?
Oh, no, I would love to if I had the chance. And in fact, a member of my research group, she's just been back from a research cruise with the Japanese, who do operate still one of the deep diving submarines, and she dived at the BB, also the one of the hydrothermal vents in the Cayman Trough just a few weeks ago. So it is possible to do that. But it's really becoming more useful now to use ROVs, and it has a couple of advantages. One is that the ROV can stay on the seafloor for as long as you want, and also everybody on the ship can see what's going on and be involved in the scientific process and the decision making as it happens.
And we're talking about depths of really thousands and thousands of meters here. Before these first expeditions discovered, did anyone imagine that life could exist in places that remote?
Yes, so there was quite a history of deep sea biology before hydrothermal vents were discovered. In the late 19th century, there was a British expedition called the Challenger Expedition, which surveyed down to almost the full ocean depth, down to 10,000 metres, just using primitive coring, sediment grabbing systems, sounding lines effectively, and brought back animal life from all depths of the ocean. And from all ocean basins, and people realised that the deep sea was quite full of life, but at the time the paradigm was that it's all dependent on an organic, also on a rain of organic material, so a rain of food coming from the surface waters. Nothing would be generated in situ because there's no light and there's no photosynthesis and there's no real ability for that to happen. It was the discovery of vents, hydrothermal vents, and later on cold seeps. You talked about water temperature, and you're right, it's not just about water temperature, it's about chemical availability to fuel those ecosystems, and that was what changed our perception of it.
And what kind of creatures have you found living in places like that?
Well, my particular interest and the interest of my research group is on a group of organisms called the polychaetes. These are marine segmented worms, and incredibly diverse, and actually quite familiar to many of us from shallow water environments, lugworms and ragworms. These are polychaetes that we know are distantly related to earthworms on land. But in the deep sea, they're very diverse. There's almost every sample we bring up, there's hundreds of new species from sedimented environments. And at hydrothermal vents, I talked in my about the bacterial mat fauna. And particularly there, we've been discovering many species that are new to science, including these unusual worms we nicknamed the candy floss worms.
And do you think there's more to discover? Have we really only scratched the surface?
I think that's fair. I think, there is definitely a huge amount more to discover. One of the things is that as you move down a route in science of knowing that there's hydrothermal vents in a certain area, there's a sort of a temptation to go back to the same area to do more research. So it's quite important that we also think of the history of this and think about how those early discoveries were made. And they were people going somewhere where no one had really been before, if that doesn't sound too like a quote from a science fiction television series. But the issue is that, yes, sometimes you may need to go off and do that to find something new and different. And I think we will find still in the oceans, for example, almost all of the South Pacific is still very poorly sampled for the deep ocean, really new and remarkable things that that will change the way we think about biology and where life can exist on our planet.
And there must be, when you're talking about the deep sea, there must be political issues here with where you're allowed to go and the kind of places that you can get access to.
Well, that's an interesting point. The politics of the deep sea is not something I've thought about much until quite recently, when we became involved in assisting people at the International Seabed Authority and some of the contractors who want to mine the deep sea with some of their environmental questions about how they're going to survey those areas and how they're going to study the animals that live there. But the reality is that areas outside of exclusive economic zones are international waters. And still, to some extent, the old concept of doesn't belong to anybody applies. Now, that's raised questions and it's led to conventions and all kinds of political discussions. And the general consensus is now is that the United Nations will look after that, those areas, and decide that not that people own it, but that the resources are there and can be used by people who want to invest in that and provide funding back to assist. I believe the International Seabed Authority, part of its remit is to use the profits from deep sea mining to assist developing countries.
And this must be quite an interesting sort of dichotomy for you as a researcher interested in the ecology of these areas. I mean, what are your thoughts about the potential for mining in these areas and what it might do to those ecosystems?
Well, you might say that as a sort of deep sea biologist, we've lived a bit of a blessed life, really, where we haven't had to think very much about these sorts of issues. If I was a rainforest ecologist, I'm sure that a large amount of my work would be thinking about which areas of the rainforest we need to protect and how we ought to balance the needs of countries that want to develop their economies with our concerns about biodiversity, for example. And those are the sorts of questions that we now need to think about and get used to thinking about. It's not simply a question that I would stand up as a deep sea biologist and say we shouldn't mine the deep sea. I mean, it's a decision that if we don't mine the deep sea, we'll be mining somewhere else. You have to think of it as balanced as you can. And I think there's reasons to be optimistic. I think that we're in a stage where, because of some of the lessons learned from some of the disasters, you might say, from other terrestrial operations, that we can use that to actually go about deep sea mining in a really modern, really thoughtful and in way that engages with industry and engages with the regulators and engages with the academic community, because fundamentally it's the only people who have been doing research there up till now has really been mainly the academic community, so we have to get involved.
So this is quite a recent development, looking into mining possibilities.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, this did start in the 1960s and 70s with the discovery of these deposits, but the technology and the costs of getting there were just so high that people were put off. And the other thing is, speaking with some of the people in the industry, is that until the regulatory framework was in place, they almost didn't want to get involved anyway. Because do you want, as a company, to go and start mining a bit of seafloor without knowing whether you have the rights to mine it for a certain amount of time and the way and how does that actually managed? In terms of getting investors to do that, that would be quite a challenge. But now there is a system in place, and there is the sort of increased knowledge and skills and experience to be able to do it more cost effectively. I think it's probably only a matter of time, really.
And we're getting a lot of questions on Twitter, mostly about this subject actually, and people are very interested in the regulation side of things, and if mining were to take place, would the scientists from your areas be involved in that regulation or hope to be part of those decisions?
Yes, I hope we would. I mean, our job as scientists is to provide the data so that the regulators can make informed decisions. And that's it. That's how we see our role. Now, the question is how the regulation happens. And that was a question in the audience. And of course, it's not easy. I mean, there's a large apparatus. The International Seabed Authority has been set up to do that, with environmental commission and legal commissions and technical commissions and reports and so on, and it's fundamentally that organisation will only exist and have strength if people support it at all levels, and that includes us as the academics, and it includes the companies that want to mine, and it includes the governments that are involved, and that has to be the way forward.
And just finally, you mentioned during the talk you were having some problems naming species, and you had a lot of worms to name. Any thoughts, any suggestions you want from the tweeters?
Well, that's fantastic. We've actually had a couple of years ago, we had a name a species event on Twitter, and we got a lot of names, so we can carry it on. I can't remember what the hashtag is, but there was a name a species, but
we'll think of one.
Yeah, if anyone out there, any of the podcast listeners, want to get in touch, then they can try tweeting at the Shell lecture, or they could get in touch with us on Twitter, and
we'll think of some some hashtags.
Yeah,
great. Well, Adrian, thank you very much for talking to me. Great lecture. It's on again at 6 o'clock in the evening, and after that you can view it online on the Geological Society website. Thank you very much.
No, thank you.